Welcome to episode 6 of the Builder's Diary by Cloudonaut. Get insights into the day-to-day challenges of builders. In this episode, Vilius from our partner Demiken shares insights into building serverless applications in a DevOps culture. Our partner Demiken is one of the largest technical consulting teams and leading Atlassian full service provider in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. Demiken is growing its cloud division and therefore hires cloud and DevOps engineers, cloud architects, and more. Demiken is a remote-first company hiring in Germany and Europe. So check out the show notes or video descriptions for details and apply today. So first of all, I want to introduce Vilius Kukanauskas, who started his career as a software developer implementing Vaadin and Spring Boot applications, for example. And in 2019, Vilius transitioned from a software to a DevOps engineer role and got in touch with AWS, infrastructure as code, Kubernetes, and so on. In January 2022, Vilius took his career in a new direction and he joined Demiken as a DevOps and cloud engineer. So welcome to the show, Vilius.
Hi, Andreas. Thanks for having me.
You have an interesting career. So you started as a software developer, and I would like to know, what did you enjoy most about writing software, about being just a software developer?
It's actually started basically from the childhood. It was fascinating for me. I can write something. Back days, it was on Commodore 64. And then it appears. I really remember my first Hello World. It was basically Hello Vilius, and it runs endlessly on the screen. And I had to turn off my computer because I didn't know how to stop the program. And for me, it was fascinating. Luckily, I still have this fascination when it works. When you try something and it works, like I'm only writing text. It's like I'm only writing, and something magically happens. Isn't it like awesome? It's like the closest we can get to magic. You write a magic spell and then it works. So this I like a lot. So when something works, when something appears on your screen which you wrote before and it works the way you want it to, it still gives me endorphin. And I think this is the main reason, why I like being a developer.
Okay, cool. And then what did you miss when being a software developer? So why did you decide to jump into kind of a DevOps role?
I was missing like the finish. I was feeling like I'm doing a part of the circle. I was writing the code, the text, but how will it become alive? In the previous companies, all the pipelines were already set up, so I only need to make Git push. And it magically appeared, like on the test server, or if you merged the main, then on the prod. But how? How did it happen? I felt like I need that to fully understand the circle of life, so to say. How will this text, which I wrote, became the living product? So that's why it was only natural for me that after I have wrote a software, I also want to deploy it. And how? Mm-hmm. It was curiosity.
Yeah. Okay. Sounds very cool, because basically that's the magic. When you write a program on your local machine and you just execute it, then it just starts working. But when you work in a more complex scenario and someone else is doing the deployment and operations, you're basically missing that part of the creation process. Yeah, I can fully understand. Yeah. I can fully understand that. So talking about DevOps, so how would you define the word DevOps, or what's behind DevOps?
Yeah, I think I have a bit more radical declaration in my mind. For me, DevOps is from two words, develop and operate. It's both. So to call myself DevOps, I need to write the service, all the good jam, the TDD, the clean code, make it nice. But then when you're done with the service, you are the perfect person on the entire planet. You are the only one who exactly knows what the service needs. You know what databases it needs. You know what environment variables needs. You know how much RAM or how much runtime. You know everything about it. So it just makes perfect sense that you are the one who also then deployed, operated. So for me, to call myself DevOps engineer, I have to do both. Write the service and operate it. if I'm only deploying software which other people wrote, then I personally don't feel like a DevOps engineer. I feel like a system administrator, or if I'm only making networking, then I feel like a cloud infrastructure engineering. So for me, the DevOps is quite specific. You write and you operate, and else you're only developer or only admin.
Yeah, and yeah, you're making a good point. So because the one who writes the code knows very much about the whole system, obviously, and is therefore the perfect match for also operating the service. And I think I would take it, I would add one more thing. It's also, you get a lot of feedback. So as a developer, if you also operate your application, you're getting a lot of feedback from production. So you see what's going on, you see maybe something that do not work very efficiently in your code or stuff like that, and you can optimize based on that feedback. And I want to share one story of my career. So I was also transitioning from a developer to a DevOps engineering role. And there was even one more thing on top, because we also did customer support for the application for a period of time. So that meant we're getting feedback from our metrics and infrastructure and everything for the deployment, but also from the customers calling in or writing emails. And this was, for the first time, I found that so useful as a developer, because I learned so much about how are people using my software, how does it work in production, how does it run on the machines and everything. So yeah, I think this is really fascinating. If you're feeling like a creator and you want to bring things into action, getting all that feedback is really, really cool.
It is also highly efficient, in my opinion, because if something doesn't work, like, I don't know, error, and then if there are two separated roles, then they're starting ticket, pushing like, hey, here, probably database is running. No, probably network. But if you have built everything, you see the error. Ah, I'm going to check the database. Ah, I'm going to check this. It's a lot faster if you know everything about your system, about the product, so you can dig deep in every corner that you need and navigate a lot faster through debugging process. Yeah. So it's efficient.
Yeah, it works well for small teams, yes. I would say, and for maybe less complex systems where you can do all of that, because it's a lot of work as well. So if you're the one writing features, doing support, doing operations, that's a lot on a list. Yes. But I absolutely, so as you don't have handoffs between people, you're not losing anything, things are working smoothly. I enjoy working in situations like that a lot. Mm. Yeah. In 2022, you started as a cloud and DevOps engineer at Demicon. So could you share what was your motivation to apply for that position?
Remote first was basically the main motivation. In the corona years, I learned how to work remotely. I was at the beginning skeptical how it's going to be, because I never before had the situation. Usually if you start somewhere, you have problems, you go to some other colleagues, you clap on the shoulder, have a chat. And I thought, how is it going to work out? And it worked out superiorly. It was super good. I just had like all the times I could ask my colleagues in the past company. We also always found time where we could make screen sharing and work together. And I enjoyed it very much. So I thought, okay, technically, I do not need to go to office anymore. We have webcams, we have screen share, we can always talk with each other. This is great. And the second, I love to sleep. When I work from home, I can sleep longer. I'm home sooner. I see my family at lunch. If I'm lucky, like there are a lot of benefits. Mm-hmm. And the benefits heavily outweigh the things like, yes, you don't meet your colleagues in real life every day. And the benefits are just a lot greater for me. So remote first was a main factor. And the second, I also wanted to try consulting, because previously to learn new stuff, to learn new technologies, I had to switch the company, which I was doing a lot. And now as a consultant, there's a chance, and so far it turned out to be true, that I can just get another client, another project inside the same company. So this is the first time for me. I have never done that before. I was always intern previously. And now I see myself more like an IT mercenary. You get into the firefighting, you will be thrown in something, and you have to do your job. So this is for me also something new, to learn something new way of working.
Okay. Yeah, so being a consultant really helps to learn about new technologies because you're constantly thrown into different projects with different tech stacks and situations. And what I also like about it, you also get to know a lot of people because you work together with many, many different people from different companies. And I think that's also, we learn a lot from that as well about different, I don't know, different team topologies or how they organize their company and stuff like that. So you can learn a lot by that as well. So, yes. So you're now working at Demicon for a little longer than a year. So can you share some of the projects you have been working on? So just a brief overview, what kind of projects have you been working on?
When I started, I was clearly communicating that I love serverless world and that I would love to work with it. And like the first project was more, we were creating a step function project. Mm-hmm. We basically had to import huge amounts of data, and all the data were chained together in lambdas. And to chain the lambdas, we used a step function, and we wrote everything with AWS CDK in TypeScript. Mm-hmm. So it was like a first for me to work with TypeScript also. And everything was written then in TypeScript, also front end, the back end, also our front end guy who was like 10 times or 100 times better in TypeScript than me, helped me a lot. He was a strict teacher. And mm-hmm. Everything was serverless. We used DynamoDB, step function, Lambda, so it was really nice. Later on, I have also moved to another project where we have more static pods running, like for all the infrastructure. If you want to deploy stuff like tools for other people, like Jira, Confluence, those are servers that need to be available all the time. So my current job is more on the deeper level, on the network level, on the permanently running pods level. This is also where Kubernetes comes in, and also this time not with CDK, but with Terraform. So those are the two biggest projects, I would say, with a few side steps to something smaller. But mm-hmm. yeah, from serverless to Terraform Enterprise and Kubernetes, those are basically my two thingies.
Okay, yeah. Quite a lot in a year, I would say. Quite a lot of different technologies to dive into. Okay. And so now we have looked back in the past year. So what do you see coming for this year? So what is the next step in your career development? Where are you heading to?
Something totally different, which I just started. And this is what I love about Demicon. I wanted this year to come out a bit out of my comfort zone. Last year, I was like hiding in the companies, like, oh, I'm only going to do technical stuff. And this year I decided, okay, step up. And I'm currently participating in a training for corporate influencer, like, so that I have to learn more how to talk and work with people on LinkedIn, how to generate content, how to communicate, how to expand my social networking. So this is something totally non-technical. And I talked with my team leader about it, and he was, yeah, go for it. We just have the training. So this is something totally new, and I'm very happy that Demicon gives me a chance to do it. Second thing also, I'm using ChatGPT almost every day in my DevOps work. it's just fabulous. It's like having an expert on your side. If I need to write something or I have some questions where I know that I can use it, I'm mm-hmm. definitely using it. And it also isn't always perfect. I also found it's outdated. It's not up to date. If I use today's version, sometimes it gave me code which simply doesn't work. So mm-hmm. I'm definitely looking forward to using more AI in my daily work. And I'm not the only one. The Demiconians are crazy about AI. So this is awesome. Maybe we can also, and this is more my personal wish, maybe we can somehow participate in the growing AI scene. Maybe Demicon can offer some solutions for all the AI startups, maybe some DevOps solutions. Maybe we can prepare something for them and then cooperate with them. But this is more my personal vision. As currently, okay. It is like network layer and keep the servers on running. This is like my today's job. So I don't know how it will be in half a year, but I'm looking forward to it.
Cool. Yeah, that sounds great. Okay. Okay. So I want to come back to the more technical part. And so you already briefly mentioned, but I want to go into detail. So What was the first time you worked on a production grade serverless application, and how did that look like?
Oh yeah, it was actually, I learned a lot in this time. We had to, our task was to move a Spring Boot application into AWS Lambdas, which mm-hmm. isn't a good fitting. It really isn't. So serverless is like for quick starts, you start in milliseconds, and Spring Boot, it starts like in half a minute and then runs mm-hmm. for eternity, and it's very fast and it's running. It's good. Mm-hmm. But like the starting time of half a minute is not acceptable for Lambda. Mm-hmm. And we then, it was brute force. We pushed it into a Lambda, the Spring Boot code. Luckily, it wasn't mm-hmm. so big, but it was still. And to make it work, actually, as a Lambda, there's some technical details to it. If you keep the Lambda so-called warm, mm-hmm. you have to like call the Lambda, and then the container beneath, it stay alive. Back in the days, it stayed alive, I think, for 4.5 hours. I don't know how it is today. It's been like 2-3 years. And then mm-hmm. if you permanently send a request for mm-hmm. that container, so it's the so-called keep alive request, then mm-hmm. you don't have this half a minute boot time for this one mm-hmm. Lambda container, which is beneath it. And we used tricked like this. So we mm-hmm. were permanently sending requests, and in the Lambda itself we had right at the beginning the recognizer. If it has the keyword stay alive, then okay, do nothing. And mm-hmm. only if it doesn't have it, then proceed the request. So it was really hacky, it wasn't good. And later on everything was rewritten. First mm-hmm. it was rewritten in pure Java, and then later it was rewritten in Golang. Mm-hmm. So but the very very first step was just to move Spring Boot into Lambda. Oh,
yeah, so actually that sounds like you've been doing a lift and shift of a Spring Boot application to a Lambda function, which is maybe a good starting point, so to get a feeling for the technology. And you just try to move it as it is to a Lambda function, and then you have to deal with all those with all the things, for example, that you have to keep the container warm and you have that startup time. So, yeah, interesting. What was the other parts of the architecture like? So you had the Lambda function mm. to answer requests. Was there an API gateway involved, or how did mm. you call the Lambda function?
Yeah, and this is where I think where it's so important, whereas as a DevOps, you make not only the Lambda logic, but also mm. write the infrastructure, because the project, the serverless projects usually are a lot more than just simply application code from Lambda. You have huge project, you have chained together queues. For example, we worked a lot with SQS, mm-hmm. simple queue services, because we had a one-to-one asynchronous message bus type, so to say. Mm-hmm. And it was streamlined, and we had logging also manually implemented. So it was about 46 different steps if I would check the entire project. So we had mm-hmm. used different Lambdas, I think maybe 10, 15 different Lambdas, different queues, serverless databases, DynamoDB we had used into it. And regarding on what logic was happening, we used like also the email services for client notifications. From today's point of view, we could have done a few things differently, but back then we were still learning. It was for us like the first, for many of us, it was the first serverless project. Mm. And we didn't know better. So, but
no, I think that's how it works for most of us. So for me as well. So you have to get a little bit familiar with the way serverless works, with its limitations, how you work around them, how you design and architect. So what would you say, what excites you about serverless architectures? What are the advantages, the most important ones in your opinion?
It's basically also a reproduction of our today's habits in service habits. As example, if you want a tap of water, you go into kitchen, open, close. This is serverless. Mm. If you would have a waterfall coming down in your bathroom where permanently water is running, this is the basic server. Which all the time. You open the refrigerator, the lamp goes on while it's open. You close it, it goes off. This is serverless thinking. You need only those resources that you need. If you need a function only to run a few times a week, what's the sense of making a pod in a Kubernetes which runs all the time, wasting resources? It's not good for the environment. So it's just be resourceful. And also you have to know when it doesn't make sense. If you have something like Jira servers running, you have Jira server running. You don't chain a bunch of lambdas. So you have to recognize when it makes sense, when to do it, and also how to do it. That you only use serverless services. When you start with one, you don't want even one like stateful, I don't know, MySQL database which is running on an EC2 machine, because it will be a bottleneck. It works fine maybe if you're getting 100 requests per minute, but what if you get like a million requests per minute? As in serverless world, everything scales up. It's fine, unless you have like constrictions made for on your own. But as soon as you have one non-serverless component, one static server running, it will be the bottleneck for everything. So go full serverless if you can. If it makes sense, try it. It's so nice. It just scales up. Chain all the nice services together. Also, you have to learn like SNS, SQS. When do you use what? What message bus do you using? You can use also for AWS the step function. It's like the to chain up the lambdas with each other. And step function has also one nice benefit for business, because it generates you a nice graph, which you can then show in your sprint reviews or for the business users who don't know how to read code. Step functions are generating also the logical graphs. So this is like additional benefit. You can like screenshot and show it to your product owner and say, look, this is our logic. Is it the way you need it? And then he can easily say, no. It's, oh, yes. So it's a benefit. It's like a given.
So when comparing running an application on virtual machines and more traditional architectures compared to running applications on serverless in production, so from an operating perspective, what's your impression about the differences here?
I think one of the challenge when you work with serverless is the logging. If you like work with lambdas and you have 100 different lambdas, every day is their own log group, find the error. it's harder, so you need a centralized logging, in my opinion. And we also use that when we were working with serverless application. You have to take care of the logging, centralize them, so you have easier browsing for them. You also, of course, have to think stateless. In a server, you might have some files or stuff like this. You don't have this in serverless world. Everything which you need to save for later on, you have to take care of it. The benefit is, okay, you will never run out into errors like, oh, disk run out of space. This isn't happening in serverless if you are planning accordingly, because you don't even save anything in the space. You know, the lambda or the, it will die in a few minutes. You will lose everything. So no, don't do that. Think differently. I think like to debug is like, you have to have all the system in your mind. If you see an error, it can be that the cause for the error has happened like two services before. So it can be more complex depending on the architecture. You have more places to look. It's not only like, I will check the server logs. No. Which?
It's not only one machine. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I think so. What I've learned a lot is, so all those serverless architectures, they basically bundle together a few highly distributed systems provided by AWS. That's basically what you do. S3, Lambda, all those things are really distributed systems that AWS operates for us. And this increases the complexity when you have to debug or also when you write code and architect. But on the upside, what you get is you get the scalability, and what I also think the availability is really important, because so when I compare applications running in containers or on virtual machines with the ones that are running serverless that I operate or responsible for operating them, then I really see that it's the effort of operating those services when they're serverless is almost zero. I sometimes get an alarm and then I see, okay, this is just a small outage on the API gateway or somewhere. I don't have to do anything about it, because that's just part of the system that basically has self-healing capabilities, does things on their own, and I don't have to, I don't know, restart a machine or log into a machine and see what's going on. And I think that's the upside. And I would say, the downside is that logging, debugging, and everything is becoming more complex.
Yeah, definitely great point. You don't need to restart a Lambda. Always free.
it does automatically, basically.
That's good.
Okay. So why do you think serverless is a perfect fit when aiming for DevOps principles of, so when building your organization in that way?
As DevOps, by my definition, you need to do both, to write the code and deploy the code. And in many cases, in serverless world, the infrastructure and the code are a lot more chained together than in monolithic approach. For example, if you work with step function, you're basically chaining different Lambda. So you have sometimes to change the formatting in Lambda itself, or you change it in the step function. So it's like, it's the same project. You just use, you can even use the same programming language. It's basically maybe a different file. The one is building the step function, which is then taking the JSONs and giving the JSONs away. And there's the Lambda who works with the JSONs. It's so interconnected. So it's just, it feels like it's not separated. It isn't different. It's just the same product. You just use like a different, a one file for this, second for this, but they are so chained together. It doesn't make sense to say, I wrote the Lambda code. It is for sure perfect. My unit tests are green. It's your fault. No, my step function is great. It's your fault. It doesn't make sense. Just understand it. Mm-hmm. Use it.
So basically the lines between dev and ops are, there's basically no line between that anymore, because the configuration of the infrastructure becomes basically part of the application, because the way I configure the API gateway has an immediate effect on how my code is running there. So those things are really coupled together very tightly, and so it's much harder to have that line. So you are responsible for the infra and you are responsible for the application code, so that's no longer really working. And I would say one other aspect that comes to my mind is, so thinking about it from a developer, the level of abstraction that you are working on here compared to, I don't know, doing virtual machines or even containers, you're not really caring about a lot of the things that we did for infrastructure on AWS. So you don't do networking typically, you don't do machines and stuff like that. So operating systems, all that stuff is gone. Basically, it's all abstracted away. Of course, those things still exist, but we don't interact. We don't see them anymore. So I think that is when you are a developer, it's interesting, because you can get started deploying your application on a cloud infrastructure without learning about networking, about operating systems, about load balancers and all that stuff, because you have a layer of abstraction on top of that.
I think that's a great point. I like the way you talk about it, like serverless projects might be the perfect place to introduce more developers, classical developers, into DevOps world, because they don't have to create all the stuff which you just mentioned, like all the network side arrays, routing tables. They don't want to do that. But for them, it's easy. Like, okay, I can use the same language which I'm using to code, and I just can create like I got a ticket. Like, if this and this happens, I need to send email. How do we do that? And we say, okay, we have the SNS, simple notification service, and we can just plug in, check it out. It's so easy. Look, this is SNS. You plug another subscriber to it, and you can send. And whoa! And most of developers which I worked with, they were so excited. It's so easy. And I said, yes, look, this is the code. Just write the function. The resource will be created. Write your Lambda, chain it up. And they're, wow, happy and want to try and play around and excited. And easy entry. I think it's important. Good point that you made. But it's a honeypot for all the, developers who would like to be DevOps. But I don't know, networking. No. Come into serverless world.
Yeah.
It's a good point.
Yeah. Okay. So we already discussed that basically serverless blurs the lines between dev and ops, and we talked about some of the services like step functions. So maybe we can dive a little bit more into detail. So how does the infrastructure become combined with the application code? So for example, when we think about step functions, can you maybe explain that a little bit? So what are step functions and how do you use them to build up your application.
Step function is actually a perfect example for application logic in infrastructure, because it's a tool from AWS, specifically like to combine lambdas, and it works by putting payloads from one lambda to another, simplified, but it can also interact on its own with the payload. So the step function, it's like a huge state machine, which then can also say, okay, in this step, I will check in the payload, and if specific parameter is like this, I will do that. And if specific parameter is not like this, I will do that. Or the step function can say, okay, I will check in the payload, and for every entry in this array, I will start a separate lambda. Like it has basic programming built in, as if then for each, and so you don't have to write everything in your own lambda. You don't have to get, oh, I will get this JSON, and then I will get for every element in this array, I need to make logic. What if there are 10,000 elements? The lambda will run out, and step function will just start for every of those entry on its own, a separate lambda. So it's a super useful tool. And you can, because you are writing the logic with this tool, it will also become, you are getting the graphical overview for it. So all the logic for each if then, you can show it to the business people, and you don't have to make your own diagram. It saves your time. So I think they have like 5 or 6 basic logic tools in the step functions. I don't know them all in my mind now, but it's usually enough to build the logic also on infrastructure level.
Yeah, I think that's the important point here. So parts of your logic is basically part of the infrastructure configuration.
Yes.
So basically the workflow defined in the step function is, theoretically, it's infrastructure as code. So you can write that with Terraform or CDK or CloudFormation. And then the lambda function that gets invoked by step function is then executing basically only small snippets of code. This is also part of your application logic. But yeah, basically now here's a perfect example, because parts of your application logic is in the workflow, which is part of the infrastructure as code, and others are part of the lambda function code, which is, I would say the traditional application code. But this is mixing those things together, and it's no longer possible that you have two different people working on that stuff, because that's crazy, because you have so many handoffs in between. So you need someone who understands both worlds, the infrastructure as code and also the application code. And that's important. And so I'm using step functions a lot as well. So I also love the way that it's really easy to invoke a lambda function, and then step function does all the things like what you said, iterating over data, or also the error handling. So when the lambda invocation fails, it tries again. You can configure that as well. And what I'm also doing often is that I also invoke other AWS services. So let's say start a container on ECS and Fargate, stuff like that. So the step function really integrates into many, many AWS services as well, which is also very cool. And then you even need less code in your Lambda functions, because you can trigger other services just from your step function. That's cool. Yeah.
We have found one downside at a step function. Maybe I can also tell it, and also how we solved it. It's more technical. I hope it's been solved by the time we're recording this, because it was a bit of pain. It's limitation to 25,000 steps, and without an ability to ask API on which step are we currently. Because we run into this problem, we migrated huge data sets, and sometimes we run into overflow. And the official solution from AWS, which we also then implemented, is like, yeah, count yourself. And after you think you're reaching the 25,000, then start another step function with the payload. Okay. And we followed the tutorial of the AWS, and we have done it. But I was so infuriated, like, you are showing this in some front of UI. You are counting. Why don't you give me the API? Maybe it's already available now. So yeah, we had to implement ourselves a counter, and it's a bit more complicated if you have a for each loop. So you have also like, okay, how do I do this? Mm. It was a bit tricky, but it was fun to solve it. So yeah, this limitation of 25,000 steps in one step function run through was for us a bit pain in the ass. We solved it, but I hope in the future it will be solved more elegant from AWS.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been running, so Michael and I have been running into this as well. So we use the step function to iterate over all objects in an S3 bucket. So this is basically the challenge. And yeah, you can imagine, so you can quickly reach that limit of 20,000 steps or transitions very easily. And yeah, so we try to figure out some workarounds as well. So, but I think, yeah, that's definitely a limit that many people reach when using step functions. And it would be great if that limit would be increased or there was some other way around it. Yeah. Okay. So can you think of, I think this was a very good example, the step function, how the infrastructure and the application logic fusions together. So can you think of another example, another AWS service or part of the architecture where this becomes possible?
Maybe also the SNS, simple notification servers, in combination with SQS, simple queue servers. Because often some events in event-driven architecture, they have to something has to happen and then something else has to happen. Like if the client clicks on the buy now, then you have to trigger multiple things. You have to check like validation. You have to check how many do we actually have this article in our storage. And all the time when you have the event-driven architecture, you can really easily chain those events with our infrastructure in AWS, for example, like with this SNS. Like, okay, if this happened, I want this, that, and that, and that. So it's perfect. Just use SNS. Sometimes they are chaining SNS with SQS so that you have more abstraction. And like one example, event-driven architecture. Just declare the events and chain them together. And one-to-one or one-to-n, whatever you want, there are tools for this. You don't have to write code, like, I don't know, in Spring Boot, like while true, run and listen, stuff like this. You can just declare the event on which we are listening. And until this event is happening, you won't waste any infrastructure power. You just sleep. And if this event, so event-driven architecture is perfect with serverless, I would say.
Yeah, so for example, and then again, so if you, for example, you configure your SNS topic for receiving events and then you fan it out to multiple queues or other topics. And again, you can have filters in there to filter specific events and stuff like that. So again, part of the application logic is based part of your infrastructure, because you no longer define that I want to listen for those events in your code, but you do it in your infrastructure code. And I think this is another very good example where those things come together. And I would say overall, this is the pattern with serverless applications. The infrastructure configuration, infrastructure as code, and the application really comes together. So when you have to deploy the infrastructure as code and the application logic, so how do you do that? How do you organize your repositories, your CI/CD pipelines to accomplish that?
In Demicon, the serverless project which we had, we basically had the same repository for the project, but we had like one was folder just called lambdas, and there were like five or six lambdas. Then we had infra folder, and in the infra folder we declared like our DynamoDB, we declared the step functions, so we actually used the same application. It was for the backend. It was basically for the backend gets a call, and we had different. We used the Grafana, and we had different data sources also declared in the SDK. So the frontend only had one endpoint, and the frontend didn't know what we're gonna use. Sometimes we were using database, sometimes we were using some other data sources. The frontend didn't know all of that, but you can declare it in the SDK, and it was also like one folder for the lambdas, one folder for the infra, but all in the same repo. It was like our last approach. I don't know if it is like the perfect approach. I don't know if it's fitting for all the projects, but for this one specific project, it was a backend who gives you information when you call him, when the frontend called him. And the frontend was in different repositories, so we separated those. But like the backend had its infra and lambdas in the same repo.
Yeah, so based on our discussion so far, so as the infrastructure's code and the application code or logic or application logic basically fusions together, so it makes for me total sense to put that in one repository so that you can also ship it with the same CI/CD pipeline and just bring that into action. Yeah, it's a it's an approach that I regularly do as well. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much for those insights. So we talked a lot about the advantages of serverless, what's great about it. So the next question is more going into what are the challenges of serverless. So where do you see our organizations or teams struggling when it comes to serverless?
Well, of course, you have to know when you're not using serverless. The computation time of serverless is a lot more expensive than, for example, of a typical EC2 machine. So if you have Lambdas running for, I don't know, for 15 hours a day, just use an EC2 machine. Just don't do it. If you don't need to, unless you need to scale up and can do it in parallel. So know when to not do it. It comes with the experience on the... on the architectural level. Also, the serverless thinking, it's more than just writing a code. Like, you have to have the entire infrastructure in your head or in the architecture. You have to think about the scalabilities. You have to think about more, I would say. It's more complex than just, okay, I will just boot up a Spring Boot application and it will somehow run. Because you have to decide beforehand, is a serverless approach a fitting one? So I would say you need a bit more knowledge. It's like the challenge. You could do it as always, just start up something and get a pod running who is empty 90% of the time, or you can learn it. So maybe also the willingness to accept this new tech is also a challenge, because if a team never worked with it, and why should they start with it? So it needs reasoning. To get team to start work with it, you have to like to make a proof of concept to show that it's what is its additional value. It's also possible that it isn't fitting for this project, but if it is fitting, it might be challenging. Depends on the team and on the project, probably. But yeah, as trying something new, you have to outweigh the pros, has to outweigh the cons. It isn't like self-explanatory, like your food tastes best. Just use salt. Hey, no, it's a bit harder than that.
Yeah. So basically, the learning curve, there's quite a learning curve involved when getting into serverless. I think it's even, so it looks very simple. When you have, at the first sight, it looks very simple. But then when you really go into architecting and developing a serverless application, you find out about all those things that you need to consider. You talked about the stateless machines or stateless invocations, basically. Then I think there's things like... yeah, it's no longer just one process running on a single machine, but it's a highly distributed system. So you can't rely on things happening in order, typically, and stuff like that. So I think those are the challenges that you then later get into. And but I think you're right. So it's about leaving your comfort zone. It's about learning a new technology. And but when you can take advantage of the things we mentioned, the scalability, availability, also I think the deployments are very simple to handle with serverless, then you can really benefit of all of that.
Yeah, agreed.
So a typical sysadmin that is coming into a serverless project, so how do you have any advice, or how do you get into that? What do you need to learn? So where do you need to get started?
Probably that there are more programming languages than Bash script.
Yeah.
And to not be afraid of it, because for developers, this is like the challenge. Or ops, I don't want to do with networks. No, don't be afraid. It's not only networking. So to not be afraid to start something, to ask the colleagues, they will be more than happy. Like a developer will be happy to explain for a new colleague from ops how the code in Lambda works. And I think at least the people who I have worked with always were very helpful and showed me things which I didn't understood how they work. So yeah, don't be afraid to look into the Lambda. You will be surprised how easy and straightforward a good written Lambda is. Just takes a JSON, does something with it, and throws a JSON away, or gives or writes it in a queue or something like that. Don't be afraid. And ask your colleagues if you don't understand something. And most of the Lambdas are really easy to understand, small pieces of code with, I don't know, limited. It's not such a huge thing. Like if you would check out the Spring Boot project, It's entirely different world. But yeah, you have to be ready to learn something new. You will need something new, but this new is actually cool. It's actually
it's fun.
I think you will have fun if you start. You will be surprised, and then you will definitely grow a lot. You will level up in real life, so to say. Go from Saiyan to Super Saiyan, because you will see, oh, so much more power. You can do so much more stuff. And I think everybody will then get its own ideas how they can do it with their job. This is like the nice thing. You give to a person a new skill, and you don't have to explain it how to do it. He will have his own ideas. So as soon as a SysOps guy will learn how to do lambdas, he will have, oh, I can automate this and that. Oh, I haven't thought about it. Oh. So I think this would be like the cool thing. And the same also for developers, if they go into DevOps, so they could say, oh, I can automate the resource creation. I can do this, I can do that. So just enable people, and then they will find the ways on how they can be better.
Yeah, I really like that motivating statement at the end. I totally agree. I totally agree on that. So thank a lot for sharing your insights into serverless and DevOps. I really enjoyed that. And if you, listener, are interested in joining Vilius and his team, so Demicon is growing their cloud division and therefore hiring. So DevOps engineers, cloud architects and more. Demicon is an advanced AWS consulting partner and remote first company. So we just talked about that already. So if you want to bring your expertise in AWS, infrastructures, code and so on, you should check out the show notes or video descriptions for details and apply to one of their open positions today. So thanks a lot, Vilius. This was a pleasure to talk to you, to learn from you, and also to get insights into your career. This was very, very, very interesting to me. Thank you a lot.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk about serverless.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Bye.